This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special.
Hülkenberg, wir brauchen dich, and welcome to Shift F1, a podcast about speedy race cars. That, by the way, is German for hurry, Hülkenberg, we need you. Something Hülkenberg heard just hours before the qualifying session on Saturday. Probably in English, though. We'll get to that. I'm Drew Scanlon. Joining me, we have Rob Zachney. How are you, Rob?
I enjoyed a race for a change. I have lots of notes from things that happened. There are lots of interesting things to discuss, so I'm happy as a clam.
Awesome. Danny O'Dwyer is on assignment today. If you are new to this podcast, a very warm welcome. And if you are new to Formula One itself, we recommend listening to our preseason primer episode, which assumes no prior F1 knowledge and explains how the sport works, who everybody is. So if you want to listen to that, it's episode 96. Also, the show is supported entirely by our audience over at patreon.com/shiftf1, where every month we release bonus podcasts and videos exclusively for our patrons, covering racing documentaries and films, F1 video games, primers on other racing series, and a lot of weird things. So if you'd like to support the show and get access to all of that fun stuff, head over to patreon.com/shiftf1 or click the link in the show notes. Most recently, we had a review of the classic, I would say, a documentary Senna, which is up on Netflix. So if you want to check out our thoughts on that, that's over on Patreon. Today, however, we will be discussing I almost said the German Grand Prix, definitely not the German Grand Prix, the Eiffel Grand Prix. But before we even got to racing, it was already eventful. Rob, can you kind of give an overview of what happened?
Yeah, it's been a weird racing weekend. There was a COVID outbreak at Mercedes, and they had to quarantine, as you do with COVID. They had a positive test. They began quarantine procedures. They had another positive test, but I think all totaled, they quarantined 6 people because that was the people. Those are the people they needed who had been in contact with some of their positive tests. So Mercedes had a lot of personnel rotating in for the F1 weekend pretty late. That might have had an impact on a couple things that happened this weekend, but Mercedes was having a bit of a chaotic weekend, but that's nothing compared to what happened over at Racing Point, where Lance Stroll got really sick, and team principal Omar Safnauer was weirdly specific about how he was sick. He couldn't leave the toilet long enough to drive a race car. However, he did keep returning negative COVID test results, because remember, there is that version of COVID where, like some people, it presents as a pretty gnarly GI bug and you spend a lot of time in the bathroom. That doesn't appear to be what happened to Stroll. He just had some kind of stomach bug, and it kind of unfolded really bizarrely in some ways, because the Friday practice was completely swamped with bad weather. It was a cold, drizzly weekend in the Eiffel Mountains. The Friday practice, where they were going to rotate through a lot of rising Formula 2 talent this weekend, that didn't happen. The entire thing was rained out. I don't know if this influenced the decision to let it ride with Stroll a little bit, because I think he was already getting sick as the weekend began. But either way, they didn't make the call that Stroll was not going to be able to drive until Saturday morning, where, cut to Nico Hülkenberg preparing for a weekend of broadcasting for German TV, having coffee with a friend on the morning before qualifying, and getting a frantic phone call from Omar Safnauer saying, hey, we need you to drive this weekend. So can you just hop in your car and come to the track and drive the Racing Point? And Hülkenberg was like, yeah. And so he just had to show up like short notice understudy style to take the helm of a Racing Point car that's been substantially upgraded and changed since the last time he drove it at Silverstone.
Yeah, amazingly, he showed up, didn't sleep at all. He says, we had meetings all night long. I studied the steering wheel, had lots of coffee, so I'm hoping I don't miss the start of the race by falling asleep. He also had to use a Renault-colored helmet because apparently that was the only one he had on hand. So he's in a pink car with a yellow helmet. But I found it interesting that they actually canceled the practice sessions, maybe not only due to the heavy rains, but it was too foggy for the medical helicopter to fly. The FIA mandates that a casualty must be able to get to a hospital in 20 minutes, either by car or helicopter, and that wouldn't have been possible given the fog. So they put a contingency in place where they said, we have created a landing area about 3 kilometers from the circuit, allowing a circuit ambulance and a helicopter to meet outside of the stratus zone, essentially a lower altitude where the thick fog / clouds generally don't form. This is from Autosport, by the way. The helicopter would then be able to transfer a patient to the hospital within the required time. So, I always love the peek into these like behind the scenes things that we don't think about, but everyone must think about, other people must intense. Think about every time.
You can see the fog still burning off as quali began. In the afternoon there, like there were still, it still looked like there were little wisps of fog that were coming off the track. So it was sort of a classic Nürburgring weekend. It's always been described from drivers in the old days, kind of a gloomy, rainy track when F1 would go through there. Maybe more importantly for our purposes, a very cold track. F1 usually chases warm weather through the season, not usually still in Europe this time of year. But there they were racing in Germany in mid-October. And boy, do people not have experience with that kind of weather.
Yeah, it was around 50 Fahrenheit or 10 Celsius, maybe maximum, the whole weekend, which means everybody's tires are basically like banana peels on the first go round at least. But the grid shook out like this. Valtteri Bottas on top, pole position ahead of Lewis Hamilton. Max Verstappen just 0.04 off of Hamilton's time in third place. And Charles Leclerc continuing to wring the most out of his Ferrari. They had new barge boards and a floor for both of their cars this weekend. Alex Albon lining up in fifth, followed by Daniel Ricciardo, Esteban Ocon, Lando Norris, Sergio Perez, and Carlos Sainz in 10th. Both McLarens running a new aero package this weekend, which, when combined with the lack of practice, apparently made the car pretty tricky to drive. Sebastian Vettel lined up 11th, followed by Pierre Gasly, Daniel Kvyat, and Antonio Giovinazzi getting to Q2 for the first time this season will start the race in 14th. Behind him, Kevin Magnussen and Roman Grosjean, George Russell and Nicholas Latifi. Kimi Raikkonen in 19th place, making history this weekend for the most F1 starts of all time at 323. And finally, Nico Hülkenberg, who qualified only, 0.2 off of Kimi Raikkonen. Not bad for a guy who had literally zero practice time.
His laps did look rough, though, in Q1. Like, he was locking up like crazy. It was a different car for him. I think he struggled with it a little bit all weekend, particularly with the grip conditions with this weather. But seeing him in Q1, he very much looked like me when I'm playing a racing game and I'm trying out like a harder difficulty level without any of the assists. Uh-huh. And suddenly it's like, oh, there's okay. Found the edge. Wait, it moved. So he had a pretty mighty struggle, that first session.
Yeah. Which prompted some drivers to say that Formula One has too much practice. Valtteri Bottas said, this is a quote from Race Fans, currently in a normal weekend, I feel like there's too much practice. Everyone finds their ways on setups and optimal things in terms of driving and the car setup. But if there would be a bit less practice, maybe some teams can get it right, some drivers can get it right, and some don't. So I kind of like it with a bit less practice. Hamilton and Verstappen both said similar things. Rob, what's your take on this?
I think there's a lot to recommend it, except that I do have a lot of sympathy for people who pay for the full weekend ticket, and I understand like wanting to see lots of running time. Particularly, we had that letter last week about what a cool experience it is being able to kind of wander a little bit and check out different parts of the track on a practice pass. So I think from a fan standpoint, it's a bit of a losing proposition for folks attending the full race weekend. But I don't know. It's so frustrating to hear this because, like, on some level, everyone's like, there is something wrong in F1. And the races are too, not procedural, but yeah, they're processional is the word.
Yeah, okay.
They're too processional. And so we get suggestions like, well, what if there were less practice and we sort of reintroduced more potential for human error? That's a possibility. That's cool. But then you see this weird recalcitrance to anything like a reverse grid idea, where somehow that's not F1. Drivers being fully prepared and engineers being able to like put the best car on the track, that's negotiable. But mixing up the order, that's anathema to the spirit. So it does frustrate me a little bit that some of the easier options to maybe juice up the show get shot down, and then something that would kind of deny your attendees a better show starts to get some traction.
Yeah. Well, Danny O'Dwyer usually takes us through the start here. I know you've got some notes. I've got some notes. What would you rather do? Take us through the start or...
I can take us through the start a little bit. All right. You just fill me in with, you know, you fill in the blanks. I'll do justice to what Danny did. So it is pretty much an interesting race right from the jump. Hamilton and Bottas both get off to strong starts. Hamilton's is a little bit stronger, and he gets out to a little lead heading down into turn one, and he uses that to sort of take the center line through the turn and force Valtteri out way wide. But going against type, Bottas doesn't back off at all. He carries all his speed through turn one. They were allowing guys to really push the track limits through turn one, letting people really cut outside, particularly on that first lap. And Valtteri sort of rejoins the track alongside Lewis and actually pulls like a little wingtip ahead of him as they head down to two, where Valtteri now has a far superior inside line position and Lewis has to back off. And Valtteri drives off with the race lead.
I thought it was a great move.
Oh, it was terrific. Once it was clear it was legal, it was edgy in all the right ways. They have some really good duels. Behind them, Ricciardo got off to a good start. I want to say that he picked up ground immediately on Albon.
Yeah, Albon locked up defending from Ricciardo, which actually I think caused Albon to have to pit pretty early on, locking up and getting a flat spot.
I actually ended up watching the start. The things I found most interesting at the start were a lot of the people closer to the back, where you started to see some really dynamic starts. Starting with like Nico Hülkenberg, he gained, I think, three positions on the first lap. But what's interesting is usually when people do that, you'll often find that they gobbled up a bunch of people at the start. Hülkenberg, you know, the old pro, didn't do that. He really hung back through turn one, kept it very clean, and then basically started making up ground once everyone was through. He started cutting through the field and picking his way forward from there, overtaking Raikkonen, coming up on Latifi. So Hülkenberg had a very good start to the race, but it was also a very pragmatic start. Giovinazzi,
I have an explanation for that.
Yeah.
Autosport says, when asked about some frantic changes being made on his steering wheel off the line and whether it was normal, Hulkenberg told Sky, quote, "No, that's not normal. I was in the wrong engine mode. Usually after the burnouts, you go into the run position, but it's two positions on the dial. And after the burnouts, I just did one. So I was in kind of a no energy mode. I noticed it and had to flip it quickly. It didn't cost me anything, but it was just not a great start."
Oh, that is funny. Yeah, because I thought he was just like doing the I'm not going to dive in to this melee. Because to be fair, a lot of people were extremely ill-served by doing that. I still don't know why Grosjean ran straight off in turn two. Did you figure this out?
No.
Grosjean loses four positions on the opening lap, but the moment where it all happens, he comes through turn one fine, and then as he approaches turn one, he like begins to turn in, and then just stops and goes straight off into the tarmac in turn two, and I do not know why. The only thing I can maybe work out is he had Raikkonen and I think one of the Williams inside him to the left. And I do wonder if he saw something in the corner of his eye that made him think that if he turned in, he would have had contact. Given the opening lap that Raikkonen had, if Grosjean was getting the heebie-jeebies around him, that might have been good driving sense, because Raikkonen did lock up and nearly run to the back of someone through two and into three, and he had to completely run off the track. So it was a little messy there.
He also got hit, Grosjean, on the finger by some gravel kicked up by Raikkonen.
Yeah.
And said, I hope it's not broken. I can't use my left index finger, basically.
Yeah, did you see a story? Did anyone pick that up? Like, did his hand get better after that? Or is he kind of screwed up?
I heard some radio after the race saying, like, oh, no, my hand's better. It's fine.
Okay. But yeah, so Giovinazzi had a good start. He went inside through turn one, but was very quick coming through two, and got underneath Vettel heading into turn three and, just bagged a whole bunch of places at the start. Giovinazzi starting to show a little bit more form. Ocon, a cursed start, I would have to say.
Mm-hmm.
He tried to cover off his inside. I think he had one of the McLarens inside of him, but he kind of did that thing where you sort of half cover off one line, but you don't close it all the way. And then what you've effectively done is you've stranded yourself in no man's land while the two real lines go around you. And he sort of got pinned there in the middle. But I do have to say, that Renault engine always sounds weird to me. Ocon, if you listen to his in-car, maybe it's just the way the car is mic'd, but again, the car sounded like shit, and it also seemed a little sluggish on throttle response. Like, assuming that, like, he wasn't doing anything egregious, you just watch him on these corner exits, and the cars around him would get that little bit of a jump through on the exit of every corner. And to me, that says, like, there was just he was a little bit down on power or throttle response. But yeah, not a good start in a season that is continuing to be kind of a disappointment for Ocon.
Yeah, so he dropped back a few spots while Norris jumped Perez and started putting pressure on Albon. Up a little further at the front, we know the Ferraris don't really have the pace to hang. Usually in the race, Leclerc did a good job holding fourth for a while, but by the time around lap nine, Ricciardo has inched closer. Ricciardo gets a DRS boost on the home straight and moves to the outside of turn one and then crosses behind Leclerc. I think they call that the cutback to keep the momentum up for the outside of turn two. And again, in the cold conditions, it's amazing that, you know, Ricciardo didn't slide off the track, but he gets it done around the outside and takes fourth place. Another really good move. Lap 11, Vettel had a weird spin down at turn one. It looked like he juked the car out of its own shoes trying to get around Giovinazzi. He said after the race, "I think I lost the car when I was crossing the wake. Certainly that was not the intention, and it destroyed my chance to do better." Turn one, turning out to be pretty tricky, especially for, or even for Bottas, from the lead of the race. Huge lockup into turn one that sends him wide, causing Hamilton to pass him for the lead. He then pitted for fresh tires, hoping to gain some kind of undercut advantage on Hamilton by lapping on new tires. Unfortunately, he comes out just behind Ricciardo, who holds him up a little bit. One lap later, let's see. Go ahead.
No, just a couple things. You know, Hamilton apparently had spotted that Bottas was graining his tires well ahead of that. So Hamilton never really let Bottas drive off. And so yet another case of, like, you kind of have to beat Lewis Hamilton at every stage of a race in order to put him away. And this was a case where Lewis, always very good on tires. That's going to be especially critical in mixed conditions like this. Lewis got a feel for managing the tires in the cold weather, and Valtteri didn't. And, you know, that loss of adhesion is sort of what causes that off in turn one. Talk about, I don't know if it was even an option for him to stay out, but again, the undercut thing, like, anything that could go wrong for Bottas from this point forward basically did.
Yeah. First, though, it goes wrong for George Russell. Kimi Raikkonen, continuing to be a wild card in this race, goes for a move on the inside of turn one on Russell. He locks up and then loses the rear, causing him to slide into Russell and just bounce him off the track as their tires touched. Could not have been comfortable for Russell. He is out of the race with a puncture and suspension damage. Raikkonen earns a 10-second time penalty and 2 points on his license. We also get a virtual safety car for the recovery of Russell's car, which means, in effect, a 13-second pit time versus the normal 21-second under green flag conditions. Hamilton, Verstappen, and Ricciardo from first, second, and fourth all pit, and the virtual safety car ends shortly thereafter. So due to luck in their track position, those guys all get an extra fast pit stop. Ricciardo comes out in ninth place, but everybody ahead of him besides Hamilton, Verstappen, and Bottas have yet to pit, so he's looking pretty good.
Apparently, Mercedes may have had a weirdly slow stop for Hamilton under that virtual safety car.
It looks like they held Hamilton because Verstappen was coming in, so they didn't want to release him unsafely. Okay. Lap 17, Kvyat going for a pass on Albon at the very tight chicane complex of turn 13 and 14, but he locks up and cuts the corner. Albon quickly catches up with him and passes, and then inexplicably cuts in front of him, clipping off Kvyat's front wing, which spins off and comes to rest on the home straight. Albon, again, was down there because he pitted on lap 8 due to the flat spot he earned on lap 1. What did you make of this one, Rob?
To me, like, I think Albon was fine. Like honestly, he's trying to, like, cut a driver's angle of attack off and sort of own that racing line. He had the run. I understand the move. Sometimes it goes a little bit bad, but to me, like, Kvyat lost it and was trying to basically make up ground from straight lining a chicane. It goes bad sometimes, but I don't, like, Albon got penalized for this, and for me, if you're trying to build that file up of, like, iffy decisions from Albon, where he puts things out of his control and puts them in the hands of other drivers or in the hands of stewards, this is another piece of evidence in that case against Albon's judgment. But me watching it, I thought it was fine in real time on replay. I still basically thought it was fine. It's just Albon when things things that seem fine and would normally be fine, Albin seems really talented at having them go wrong. But here I don't feel that his decision was necessarily the bad one.
Yeah, I don't. It looks like he was just trying to get in position for the upcoming turn, but I don't know why you need to do it so quickly. I don't know. To me, it seemed like, don't you, like, Kvyat's already slowed. He would have had to give that position to Albin anyway. Why be really aggressive with him and not give yourself a millisecond more before you moved over to clear? I don't know. But I'm kind of with you. Trouble just seems to find Albin. We get yellow flags for Sector 3, but no safety car. And the woes continue for drivers. Bottas, who was in third and at one point was leading this race, goes out with a suspected MGUH problem. And then four laps later, Ocon goes out with what sounds like a hydraulics problem. And then a lap later, Albon, who not only had a cooling problem, but also that 5-second penalty for the incident with Kvyat, goes out of the race. Apparently, Horner said he picked up some debris and that pierced a radiator in the car. He also picked up 2 penalty points on his license. And it doesn't
Norris.
Stop there. Yeah. Lap 26, Rob.
Yeah, no, just the attritional phase of this race was pretty pronounced. Norris puts in his first distress call, basically, for an issue with his engine. And unlike every other driver for whom things go from, like, fine to disastrous, like, instantaneously, Norris has to drive a miserable Grand Prix from here forward. The thing he says is he's not getting throttle response. He's down on power. The engine is sluggish to respond. And immediately it goes into... sort of throwing everything at the wall, troubleshooting in terms of things that he can do on a steering wheel to reboot it. But he is getting, and will continue to be, getting increasingly frazzled. By lap 30, he's saying that, you know, the power problem is getting worse. And then at some point, they just kind of told him, look, man, you're going to have to manage it. You're doing great in the corners. And so he's basically like told, you know, lean into this part of your driving style, but there's nothing we can do. Just try to, you know, defend what you can. And it's probably the most frazzled I've seen Norris in mm-hmm. a Grand Prix. You know, before all is said and done, he's basically lightly bickering with his race engineer over the comms. But yeah, Norris has kind of a cursed race from here forward.
Yeah, so he rejoins after that pit stop and tries to fend off Perez, but Perez makes quick work of him at the chicane and takes fifth place. Four laps later, Perez then attacks Leclerc at the final corner. But Leclerc gets DRS right after that and retakes the position on the home straight. A lap later, though, Perez tries it again and manages to stay far enough ahead that time to keep fourth position. But yes, lap 44, Norris's woes continue as he pulls off the track with an engine problem. Although, judging by the burn marks on the outside of the car, it looks like the McLarens are powered by the Ark of the Covenant. Maybe that's just me.
Yeah.
The same issue, apparently, with this car that caused Sainz to miss the start in Spa. Team principal Andreas Seidel said, and this quote from Autosport, there's an issue on the ignition side, which is causing unburned fuel going into the exhaust, and then it goes kaput. We tried to get out of this protection mode the engine goes into when having such an issue, but unfortunately it wasn't possible because the problem was constantly there. Unfortunately, Norris's car is on its last set of parts before he has to start taking penalties. And we get a safety car, where a bunch of people pit. Hamilton, Verstappen, and Ricciardo in, again, first, second, and fourth. Crucially, Perez decides to trade a pit stop for third place position on the track. Leclerc and Grosjean also opt not to pit. Leclerc, it means for him that he gets to keep sixth place, and for Grosjean, it means he moves from 10th to 7th place. But again, everybody's tires are like 14 to 16 laps old here, so it's a gamble. Much complaining from Hamilton and Verstappen about the speed of the safety car and how long it was out. Hamilton saying it's not safe, presumably because everyone's tires will be cold for the restart. Race director Michael Massey said after the race that there is a requirement in the sporting regulations to wave all lapped cars past. I think from that point, it was position 6 onward that was still running. So 10, 11 cars that had to unlap themselves, and therefore the safety car period was a bit longer than what we would have normally expected. So the role of the safety car in this situation is to first slow down the field for the safety of the track workers. And then once the track is clear, lapped cars get to pass the safety car and then reform behind the lead group for the restart, which takes time. Especially in these conditions, it allows the tires to cool because the cars aren't putting any pressure on them. So what do you think, Rob? Should we just restart with the back markers in play?
I don't know. I think I like the idea of unlapping, letting those cars unlap themselves and getting them clear so that you have a bit more of a shootout at the front and so that those guys can just race without worrying about blue flags. The more radical proposal I've heard, I think, from James Allison was doing an AMA on Reddit where he was asked, what's your controversial F1 take? Like, what change should they make? And his was, let's get rid of blue flags. Let's stop making it so that the fast cars just expect everyone to part and it turns into you have to work to lap people and get them out of the way. That could be more interesting than what we've got right now, which is for a number of years, you know, there've been a handful of teams on the lead lap and then everyone else is just kind of keeping an eye out for a blue. This was a case where the complaining, and I know the tire temperatures were low and it was worrying drivers, but I just couldn't, I didn't care that much. To me, it was like, yeah, it's a cold day. Sometimes it's going to be that way. F1 is a sport where conditions can be bad and you are expected to overcome those conditions. And this notion that, you know, they needed to be running at a faster pace so the tires could get back into their infinitesimally small, like optimal performance range. Who gives a shit? you know, drive the car.
Yeah. And maybe this is not a safety car problem.
Yeah.
Right. Maybe this is a tire problem. I thought it was interesting seeing Hamilton use the DAS system here, moving his wheel forward and back to change the angle, the toe angle of the front tires. We've explained this before, but when he pulls back on the wheel toward his chest, the front tires angle ever so slightly inward, like you're pigeon-toed. And then by virtue of that, scuff along the ground a little more and warm up the tires more than someone who does not have the DAS system. Toto Wolff, who I think would be keen to downplay the advantage this gives Mercedes cars, says, the DAS helped a little bit. It's not the game changer, the silver bullet, like everyone believes, but it is a good tool to keep a little bit more heat in the front. I don't know if they showed this on the main feed because I, like you, I believe, Rob, was watching the race from the pit lane feed. Do you want to talk about your experience with that?
I mean, you know, I think we've had a couple of letters about it, but mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a very, it feels like you're seeing much more information at all times. The pit lane feed goes into a partitioned three-pane display with a main camera angle and then two other cameras, usually in cars, running concurrently, often showing things unrelated to what's happening in the main frame. And so you'll be keeping abreast of two, sometimes three, bits of action happening at different parts within the field. Alex Brundle and Alice Powell were the commentators for this race on the Pit Lane channel.
Alex Jakes, I believe.
Pardon?
It's Alex Jakes and Alice Powell.
Oh, was
Powell.
It? I thought it was little. I thought it was little
Brundle. Yeah, Brundle was, or Alice subbed for Brundle. Alex Jakes is the play-by-play.
Yeah, but he was like it was a good commentary team, and I think I'll say this. I like Crofty. I think, and I understand how this ends up happening. We've both done like personality-led content, like at various points in our careers. Arguably, that's what the show is to an extent, but. One of the things you run into with that kind of thing is you originally show up and you're there to your primary focal point is the topic, the thing you're covering. And then people like enjoy the little bits where the mask cracks and people show like their personality a little bit more. And you will always get more encouragement to do that. You will always get the feedback like, oh, we love it when you guys go off topic and tangents, etc. And because usually that's nice feedback, you'll want to believe that more. But if you follow that impulse all the way down, eventually you're kind of phoning in the primary commentary. And sometimes I feel that's where Sky ends up, where like you'll have Crofty like noticeably disengaged from what's happening in the race, or doing kind of like weak banter with Ted Kravitz, as two guys who worked together for ages, and have a good rapport, but like I heard more about Crofty's thoughts about socks and sandals this weekend than I really need to, and you just get less of that on the PLC. So I think that's the other dynamic is the Pit Lane channel, because there's so much happening on the cameras and the commentators are kind of racing to cover all of it. It does feel a little bit more tuned into what's happening in the race, whereas main feed sometimes can feel a little bit detached. And so I think that was the other thing is PLC is showing more, and also it felt like the commentators are just a little more interested in seeing more of what's happening.
Yeah, I guess we should point out it's called the Pit Lane channel, but it's really sort of a misnomer. It's not just a camera in the pit lane. It's just their alternate. It's kind of like the video wall in Back to the Future 2, where they just pull up, you know, as many video feeds as they can. It reminds me a lot of NFL Red Zone, if you've ever watched that. It's just like an assault of information on you. It's kind of exhausting to watch, honestly.
Yes.
But you're right, because of by virtue of the fact that there's so much information, the commentators must be focused at all times. And I wouldn't recommend it to like a casual Formula One fan. Like, I don't think, you know, my parents should watch the Pit Lane channel. I think it's too much. But I think for people listening to this podcast, you should check it out. If you have, so it comes with F1 TV, Formula One's official streaming service. So if you have access to that in your country, I don't know. I think it's probably frankly, the most compelling reason to get F1 TV if it is not your only option. So, thumbs up here from me as well. All right, restart on lap 50. It looks like this: Hamilton, Verstappen, Ricciardo, Perez, Sainz, Leclerc, Grosjean, Gasly, Hülkenberg in ninth, Giovinazzi in 10th. And Grosjean in seventh. Amazing. Hamilton, partially due perhaps to that DAS advantage, pulls out to an early lead. Ricciardo has a great restart too, forcing Verstappen to take a defensive line into turn one. Ricciardo tries his turn two move again around the outside, but can't pull it off, and then has to defend from a charging Perez, who nearly gets him on the inside of turn three. Lap 55, Vettel and Magnussen get into a little scrap at turn two, touching wheels. Vettel coming out on top for 11th. I thought this was good hard racing. What do you think?
Yeah, same.
Which you have to do to Magnussen.
You do. And again, if anything, it was a pattern this weekend. I feel there were a lot of folks who cut through the chicane at Nürburgring and felt like, well, that was punishment enough. Time to resume racing. And I did kind of feel like maybe that chicane does need some sort of Senna-esque escape road to force people to slow down a little bit more, because it certainly did feel to me like you certainly didn't necessarily gain advantage from cutting that chicane. But here's the thing. By definition, straight lining a chicane means you fucked up the approach and you were, you know what I mean? Like, that was your escape from a larger mistake. You're just sort of going over it. And so, do you gain advantage? No. But in some ways, the lack of disadvantage from cutting the chicane, I think, makes it a little advantageous compared to what your pace would have been had you, like, properly corrected for the mistake. Magnussen, and far from the only one, I did feel a lot of folks struggled with that chicane and just resumed the battle as soon as they were four wheels back on. And it made for some good racing. But I did kind of, my eyebrows were a little bit raised at how you saw circuit rejoins from that chicane being handled, as opposed to some of the more baroque approaches we've seen in other parts of other courses this year.
Well, this good race came to an end on lap 60 with Lewis Hamilton on top, tying Michael Schumacher's record of 91 wins. During the post-race interview, Michael's son Mick presented Hamilton with one of his dad's race helmets, which is a pretty cool moment. Hamilton also said, I remember playing Michael in a game called Grand Prix 2, I think it was. And I think at the time I was playing you at one stage too, referring to David Coulthard, who was interviewing him. You can see Danny's overview of the first game in the Grand Prix video game series over on the Shift F1 YouTube channel, youtube.com/ShiftF1, or I'll put a link in the show notes as well if you want to see what those 90s racing games look like. Second place, Max Verstappen, who also got the fastest lap. And what do you know, in third place, he holds on to it. Daniel Ricciardo fends off Sergio Perez to take the team's first podium since, I think, 2011, and earning Cyril Abiteboul a tattoo. Horner mentioning to Verstappen at the end of the race that he'd like to see a big Red Bull on Cyril's butt. So I guess that's... Ricciardo did say, number one, yes, that's happening. And number two, he was going to make it German-themed.
Perfect.
There is a great clip from after the podium ceremony of a reporter asking Ricciardo why he didn't do a shoey. And you can see that Ricciardo completely forgot about it. And he's like, oh no, I can't believe.
I've run back to the podium. Yeah.
Right. He did make up for it later in his trailer. I will link both of those clips in the show notes as well. Fourth place, Sergio Perez. Fifth place, Carlos Sainz. Followed by Pierre Gasly, Charles Leclerc. And what do you know? The VIP, the substitute, Nico Hülkenberg, making it up to 8th place from 20th with zero practice in the car, earning him a well-deserved driver of the day. And hey, Romain Grosjean, his first points of the season in 9th place. He posted a picture of himself on Instagram holding two German beers saying 2 points equals 2 pints, right? I like Grosjean. I like online Grosjean. And yeah, turns out his finger was okay after the race as well. And rounding out the points, Antonio Giovinazzi doing well to make it up to 10th place. Sebastian Vettel in 11th. Kimi Raikkonen in 12th, again setting that record of most Grand Prix starts. His engineer saying, I know it doesn't mean much for you, but we're very proud to see this moment. See you later. Kevin Magnussen in 13th. Nicholas Latifi in 14th. Daniel Kvyat in 15th, and then not classified were Lando Norris, Alex Albon, Esteban Ocon, Valtteri Bottas, and George Russell. And as a Shift F1 listener, Matthew Lewis points out, 9 teams got points in this race, which is amazing to me.
All it takes is an unusual number of DNFs, and F1 gets real good. I think that's the other thing. Is like, this was an exciting race, an interesting race, but it definitely is. What was the other one that was just like mechanically like just carnage filled earlier this year from I think Bad Curbs?
Yeah, Austria maybe.
I feel like it was Austria, but yeah, we definitely good things happen when these sort of Swiss timepiece designed F1 cars like. Which by their nature maybe do not have the most rugged design constraints put on them, that definitely can make for a more interesting race.
Well, the driver standings now look like this. Lewis Hamilton still on top with 230 points. Valtteri Bottas has 161, Verstappen with 147. Daniel Ricciardo pulls a little bit of a lead on the very close mid-pack in fourth place with 78 points. Sergio Perez just behind in fifth with 68. Then we've got Norris with 65, Albon with 64, Leclerc with 63, Stroll has 57, Pierre Gasly in 10th with 53, Sainz has 51. Then down to 12th place, Esteban Ocon has 36, Vettel has 17 points, Daniel Kvyat with 14, Nico Hülkenberg, still 15th place, with 10 points. Antonio Giovinazzi has 3 now. Kimi Raikkonen and Roman Grosjean both have 2. Kevin Magnussen has 1. And the Williams boys, Nicholas Latifi and George Russell, still with 0 points. In constructors, Mercedes has 391. Red Bull's in second with 211. Racing Point's in third with 120, but McLaren just close behind, 116, and Renault with 114. Ferrari has 80 points, Alfa Tauri with 67, Alfa Romeo has 5, Gene Haas and team have 3, and Williams again with 0. All right, should we take it to the news?
Let's get into it.
So, speaking of Nico Hülkenberg, Red Bull's Helmut Marko, always one to weigh in on literally everything, says that Nico Hülkenberg could be a 2021 option. I'll just read his quotes here from Autosport. Speaking to German channel Sport 1, Marko said, "We can call the names that are available on the market. This is Hülkenberg and this is Perez. The question is how far away they would be from Max. We have comparisons with Ricciardo, and we can draw conclusions where the drivers stand. I don't think that anyone would get closer than 0.3. On good days, Albon is also able to create this proximity to Max. Albon is young, but we are aware that if he can't stand the pressure, we can't afford to be standing on one leg when it comes to the world championship. That is the situation. It's actually impossible for a world championship if you only have one car in the action, but we are not there yet. The performance of Albon at the Nürburgring was satisfactory. That's just the situation. Up to now, we have always recruited our drivers from our own junior squad, but there's nobody here at the moment. We do have a Japanese driver who is very fast, but this would be his first year. And to put, I think that's Tsunoda?
Yeah.
And to put him in a top team like Red Bull Racing for the first year would risk burning him out. We are not planning to do that. That's surprising. So we would have to go the way most other teams do, to rely on proven drivers. We are actually already clear about 3 positions, said Marko in reference to the likelihood of Tsunoda stepping up with AlphaTauri alongside Pierre Gasly. We want to make the 4th one by Istanbul in mid-November at the latest. Wow, all right, that's a lot. I feel like drivers are such temperamental people, you don't need to add more pressure to them. That is something that Red Bull does not seem to understand. So either that's what he's doing here, or he's like laying the groundwork for when they eventually replace Albon, he can point to this and say, well, it just wasn't quite good enough.
I do not think much of I don't think much of the way Red Bull's handled this. And I mean, I'm not saying like Albon specifically. I think at a certain point when you've had multiple driver promotions from your vaunted, from your vaunted development program through Toro Rosso, AKA AlphaTauri, and all of that part of the pipeline works. It produces good drivers. They are capable F1 drivers. It's all good. And then when it comes time to making the jump into Red Bull Racing, it keeps going wrong. It went wrong with Kvyat. It went wrong with Gasly. And now it's going wrong with Albon. And the only driver it has not gone badly for is Max, who, one, is unusually talented, probably by F1 standards. Two, clearly had probably more confidence from the team going in, like more visible backing from the team than any of their other drivers. They couldn't really retreat from Max in the way they could these other drivers. And three, Max has spent his entire life in a pressure cooker situation with adults around him. The stories about how Jost Verstappen both behaves as a person but also trained him as a driver suggest that you're not going to find, and thank God, you're not going to find too many Max Verstappens out there who've had those kinds of expectations thrown on their shoulders from a young age. So I look at this and I see Helmut Marko. Well, this is the other thing. Marko and Horner, I both feel, love talking to reporters. They can't stop. And so they end up basically peeling back their deliberations in real time. And whether that's part of coded language to the drivers or whether it's just the fact that they're in love with building these relationships with the press, I don't know. But we keep coming back to the situation where they're kind of, paying lip service to the idea of developing drivers and giving them room to grow, but then also doing the Dread Pirate Roberts thing where, tomorrow I'll kill you. And that's kind of the way they seem to be playing it. And at a certain point, you have to look at the pipeline that seems to work right up until Red Bull Racing. And then, for some reason, everyone who gets promoted to that team struggles in the number two spot. And at some point, you just have to assume it's probably not all these individuals who are just failing to measure up. It's probably something systemic.
Yeah, and it doesn't show any sign of changing.
So, question for you, though. Does that mean...
Okay.
Is Kvyat cooked? So
he doesn't mention him at all there.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. He says, we've got three positions that are locked up. And he specifically rules out sending Tsunoda to Red Bull Racing for his first year, but he doesn't say anything about AlphaTauri. So is Kvyat just done? I mean, I understand walking away from him at this point, but
yeah, I mean, it sure sounds like it.
Yeah. So what would it be like? Gasly continues to develop at AlphaTauri. Kvyat and Albon are both handed their walking papers. You promote Tsunoda and hope that he is your next big thing. And then you find somebody who will just perform within an acceptable standard deviation from Max. Basically the Valtteri to Max's Lewis. 3/10 is an interesting number to pull. I think 3/10 is the clearly somebody who won't be as good, but is is comparable. I don't know. I mean,
if you want someone consistent and apparently is good at getting in a car that's tricky to drive and performing, that's Hülkenberg, right?
Yep.
The what little I've heard about, like explanations for Albon's performance is that, you know, he, unlike like Max, can just feel the grip, and that the Red Bull is maybe tricky to drive for. For these new guys, like I think Horner was even saying that it was the same deal with Gasly. Like he and Albon both have problems feeling the grip of the car. And you see this sometimes with across motorsports. Like, I think the Repsol Honda MotoGP bike is very, very difficult to ride. And Marc Marquez is just an alien, and that's how he can do it. But, like, you put any other rider on there. Like, they put Jorge Lorenzo, a championship rider, on the bike last year, and he was in last place, like, all the time. So it's not, like, I don't think you can, you know, ignore that part of it. And so if you want somebody to get in your tricky car, I feel like that is Hülkenberg.
Yeah.
Speaking of Honda and their friends, what's going on? Any new developments on their engines?
Not so much new developments, just the picture of the landscape around engines is becoming clearer. So Dieter Röntgen over at RaceFans has always been doing a lot of good business reporting around this issue. One of the things that was pointed out is Honda being a bit hypocritical. Like, were they just finding a justification for leaving F1 when they said, we need all heads being dedicated to the problem of, you know, carbon neutrality. And in the meantime, they're continuing to power IndyCar. And so there was some question around, like, okay, well, what's going on there? Because they're not even running a hybrid in Indy, right? That's just an internal combustion engine. They're considering going to a hybrid in the near future, which means IndyCar is like a decade behind where motorsport is more broadly. Honda was asked about this, and you know, their response was, look, Honda Performance Development is basically an American part of the company. That is a separate R&D unit. That's a separate business unit. They build those engines, and they have chosen to maintain that relationship. Honda's argument is that from the Japanese side of the company and their sort of main R&D division, that touches on these sort of initiatives, everyone needs to go over into net zero technologies. Because for one thing, in Honda's, as Honda laid it out, Honda is such a huge company that produces so many different lines of vehicle that it's not like Honda has one engine to roll out and that's going to be the way they get to that objective. They basically got to find solutions for sedans, for trucks, for SUVs, for basically, like, delivery trucks and, you know, heavy tractors. Like, Honda's kind of everywhere. And so they do not have that many engineers available. They're going to need to tap all of them to begin putting the company on the trajectory for this goal. Which is maybe true. Could also be justification. Röntgen did point out that Honda cannot win for losing at F1. The company is always one foot out the door every time they come back into F1. And what that often means is they weren't a stakeholder. They didn't have a seat at the table when the turbo hybrid era was basically being laid down into law. Honda basically arrived late and just had to accept these specs that they'd had no hand in shaping, whereas everyone else had been part of those conversations. And in Röntgen's telling, like, Honda follows this pattern of saying, you know, arriving late and then realizing, hey, these regulations are tricky, and then kind of complaining that they didn't have a hand in shaping them and that they're kind of trying to play catch up. And that was kind of the pattern they played. They played in F1 with this most recent go-round. The other thing that is looming over all of this is this kind of this crisis of, like, what is F1 going to do with this supplier shortage? The business of making F1 engines is not actually lucrative. Again, Röntgen went digging into Mercedes' public statements and did the math on the part of Mercedes that produces the F1 powertrain. And there's about 400 people working every year on the F1 engines that, Mercedes sells. Costs about 31 million euro to run that part of the company. So that, just so you know, is enormously expensive compared to like what an internal combustion engine R&D program costs. Like, it's just, it doesn't compare. This is why Cosworth stayed away from F1 entirely, because kinetic recovery is not a hard problem to crack. Thermal recovery is. Like, the minute you introduce these sort of two-layered recovery systems, you are just in a different category of engineering challenge that becomes both difficult and expensive to solve. So Mercedes spends all this money just on basically the brains who are thinking about this problem and like fabricating parts, etc. When you do the math of what they are allowed to charge to F1 teams, because this is sort of as part of F1's various like half-ass stabs at cost control, they've tried to create like fixed price schedules for F1 power units, which means there is kind of a ceiling, I guess, on what a motor can cost in F1. If you do the math on that, there's a good chance that some of the companies who are major engine suppliers are not making a profit on these sales of engines and the parts to maintain them. Because when you think about like what the engines cost to make and then what all that sort of after sale support costs, it isn't a real good value proposition. And so anyone making engines in F1 is not really there to be making bank doing it. And that creates... So Andreas Seidel over at McLaren has sort of been floating this idea of F1's got to get independent engine manufacturers back in this, Cosworth being the example of a company that should want to be part of F1. It's got racing DNA, open wheel experience, but Cosworth's wanted to stay out. And the thing is, though, that F1, we touched on this last week, to have a profitable engine manufacturer and sales business, you've either got to change what you're allowed to charge for those engines, which immediately probably threatens the participation of some of the teams on the F1 grid. So that's a non-starter for F1. Or to make it attractive to like third-party companies, like what Honda was doing, like what people imagine Cosworth doing, you are probably then talking about less sophisticated, less demanding engines. But Honda just left because the place where F1 appears to be headed, technologically speaking, is not where they see the future of automotive engineering going. If they back off and say, we need to run cheaper engines so that like we can get companies like Cosworth and whoever into this, how long before... Now you hear that from Renault. Now you hear that from Mercedes.
Yeah.
Where everyone's looking at it and saying, how does this dovetail with the future of saving cars in a carbon-choked planet? It doesn't. So This is... It's not an immediate crisis because, you know, by some measures, you got till 2026 to figure this out when the new engines are going to be loaded onto cars and raced for the first time.
Yeah, because we're keeping the same engines, even though the look of the cars will change in 2022.
Right, and then there's a weird engine freeze in 2023. You get the development.
Right? Okay.
You get progressive development freezing from next year. And I'm not sure how all that's going to work, but there's basically a changeover time where, like, the engines kind of spend a season, developmentally speaking, encased in glass, which I don't know what that means what if your engine sucks? what if the last engine you rolled out is a lemon? I don't know. Also, I'll have to look more into the mechanics of that, but... Yeah, so F1 kind of does have time to figure this out, but it's a really demanding R&D challenge, and it's about the future of the sport. So to an extent, you don't have time because the key decisions and conversations are going to be happening now.
Yeah, I saw an article that I didn't pick up here, but Ross Brawn said something like, you know, we will have to take, not feedback, but like we'll have to develop the 2026 engine rules with engine manufacturers for, I think, exactly this reason, you know, because if they couldn't keep Honda around, you're right, it's because it's not where that company is going. But if Honda isn't going that way, you got to believe that everyone else is like maybe tipping that direction too. So I think that would be a wise decision for F1 to consult those guys. Fantasy standings here. If you'd like to join our fantasy league, you can do so with the link in the show notes. For the German Grand Prix, here are the top three. It's actually tied for number two. We have Hot Carl Motorsports, and I'll show you my data if you show me yours. And then number one, Sausage Curb Launch Control from Australia. The other two from America. Overall standings, however, we have a familiar name in third place. That is Louder Than Life from Kenya. And then in second place from Canada, Back Das Haas Up. And number one from America, simply Black Lives Matter. And that's fantasy. If you'd like to send us an email, you can do so at shiftf1podcast@gmail.com or hit us up on Twitter at @ShiftF1Podcast. That's us around the internet. Now, let's take it around the world, shall we?
Let's do it.
DTM is in Zolder. For round eight. The IMSA WeatherTech Championship is at Road Atlanta for the Petit Le Mans. The FIA World Rally Cross Championship is at the Barcelona Catalunya circuit. MotoGP is in Motorland Aragon in Spain. The Motocross Grand Prix is in Portugal. Supercars. Let's see. This is listing the Super Cheap Auto Bathurst 1000, but I believe that has been delayed. Check your local listings. We also have the NASCAR Xfinity Series racing at the Kansas City Speedway. The Kansas Speedway in Kansas City. We have Camping World Truck also racing there in the Clean Harbors 200. By the way, the Xfinity Series is called the Kansas Lottery 300. And NASCAR is also racing at the Kansas Speedway in the Hollywood Casino 400. I don't know if you know this, Rob. Hollywood is in Kansas City. A lot of people know that.
It's a crazy different world we're living in than just a few months ago.
COVID changes everything. And that's Germany. We have another raceless weekend. Back to the old 2-week break. But we will be back next week with a pre-show for Portimao, which is a new track for me. And I think for a lot of F1 fans. Rob, final thoughts on this race?
It was good. Nürburgring, better than I remembered. Racing in Europe in the colder months. Maybe the real key to good racing. So let's see more of that.
Agreed. If you'd like to support the show and get access to all of our bonus episodes, you can do so over at patreon.com/shiftf1. Have a good race weekend, everyone. We will see you all next week.